Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome.
Hi, and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast. I'm Claire Maddalena, and today we have the brilliant Erin from Better Birth UK joining us. I must admit, this is the second time we've recorded with Erin. We had a little bit of a tech nightmare first time round, so she's very kindly jumped back on with us. And I can't wait to get into the conversation with her about all the things she's passionate about, because I think you're going to love it too. Erin, welcome to our little show. It's lovely to have you. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me back on again.
Oh, it's really our pleasure. So sorry that it didn't quite work out the first time. And I've been, you know, obviously tracking what you've been up to on Instagram, and you look like a very busy lady, sharing your amazing, amazing stuff. So I'm just so grateful you're here again. Why don't we just do a very quick intro so everybody knows who you are, if you just want to let them know, you know, a little bit about your journey to this place where you've got to with your work and your offering. I think that would be a really nice start.
Sure. So, my name's Erin. I'm a mum of three. I've got two girls who are 8 and 11 and a little boy who's 4. And my background really is marketing, actually. So I worked in Canary Wharf in marketing, corporate marketing, for 15 years. And I really changed careers because of my births, my three births. So my first birth was less than positive, I think it's safe to say. I did probably what most people do and didn't do any prep. I didn't prepare for birth. I didn't read up on my options. I went in completely and utterly blind, because I thought, there's no point prepping. You can't control what happens when you give birth. The doctors and midwives are the experts. They know what they're doing. I'm going to leave myself in their capable hands. And it's interesting, because I did request my maternity notes after I had my third baby, and they sent me all three births. And reading through the maternity notes is really interesting. So my first birth, my daughter was classed as small for gestational age, which they never mentioned to me at all throughout my entire pregnancy. And when I got to 40 weeks, they suggested, let's book you in for an induction, which I went, fine, okay, because that's what you do when you go past 40 weeks, right? I remember the midwife saying, oh, we'll book you in now because it's quiet and we have beds, which, you know, makes my blood boil now, because that's not a medical reason for an induction. But I went along with the induction, again, completely blind. You know, no one prepped me for induction. Nobody explained to me what methods they would use, what the risks were, what the process was, how long it could take. And I had the induction. It was very long. It was very uncomfortable. I was absolutely terrified because I didn't know what to expect. And it was very uncomfortable. And unfortunately, I was stuck with a very unfriendly midwife as well. And my daughter's heart rate started dropping, because I was obviously on a continual monitoring CTG. And my husband said to the midwife, you know, is this normal? And she kind of fobbed him off, and he kind of thought, well, I don't think this is normal. So he went out and got a doctor, and the doctor came in. And then all of a sudden, there was all these people piling into the room. They were waving forceps. They gave me an episiotomy. I'd had an epidural by this point, so I couldn't feel anything, and they were telling me to push, and I was like, I don't know if I'm pushing, I can't feel anything. And it was just all really, really traumatic, to be honest. And then I think probably because of all of the drugs and all of the, you know, the process of birth, she was exhausted, I was exhausted. I didn't manage to breastfeed. I ended up really struggling for the first 12 months with a child who had severe silent reflux, which again, I was just gaslit and fobbed off and, you know, babies won't starve themselves. And she did. She had undiagnosed cow's milk allergy amongst loads of other allergies as well. I spent the first 12 months of being a parent, being shut in a dark room, feeding a child just 24 hours a day. It was really, really hard. And I had awful postnatal depression, which I refused to admit and didn't medicate. And just the only reason I got out of it was because I went back to work, like handed my daughter over to my mum, feeling like a horrible person, just being relieved to hand her over to somebody else to deal with. And I wasn't actually going to have any more children after that because I thought I can't go through that again. But then I thought, you know, after a couple of years, I thought I don't want it to be an only child. So I got pregnant again and I thought I'm not going through that again. I'll do some prep. So I did a hypnobirthing course and got myself a doula who was like a non-medically trained birth partner. To be there and in attendance when I gave birth, and had an amazing birth in my local midwifery unit, had a water birth. And then my third baby, my son, was a surprise. and had a home birth with him, again, used hypnobirthing. And after I gave birth to him, I thought, this is life-changing. Like, the hypnobirthing and all of the prep that I did is life-changing. And I feel like I'm not adding value to the world doing what I'm doing now. I really want to train and change careers. So I trained and I changed careers and I've been doing hypnobirthing and antenatal classes since. I think I probably make more of an impact with my social media than I do with my actual classes. Obviously, I make huge difference teaching one-on-one, but I get so much joy out of hearing people's stories from people that just follow me on Instagram and those little snippets of information that I share that kind of educates in a kind of bite-sized way. And yeah, I'm just really passionate about making sure people are well-informed and educated and they know where to get their information and just to ask questions, really, because we all know a lot of birth trauma is preventable in some cases with some prep and the right support. And so that's my passion, kind of, you know, helping people prevent a negative experience.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us. And it's really clear, you know, where your passion for helping people get really informed around induction specifically has come from. And then that lovely little piece that you just shared about your second and your third births being so kind of healing and transformative for you. You know, you really had that experience of an empowering and positive birth. I'm not saying they were pain-free or easy, but comparatively, like Erin's shaking her head, nope. But comparatively, they sound like they were very, you know, reflecting that back, very sort of healing and life-changing for you in a really, really positive way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you must hear from so many people. I absolutely love your Instagram account. I think you kind of shoot from the hip and you say it how it is, and you know you don't hold back. And I think it creates quite a good reference point for people who might not know anything about the risks associated with, well, let's just book you in for a sweep next Tuesday. You know, that sort of assumptive language that just assumes that you know everything about it and that it's just a little sweep, isn't it? That's not really induction. It's just, we'll just give things a nudge along. Whereas when you kind of open the Pandora's box a bit, you realize that that is actually the first stage of an induction. So for people that might be pregnant at the moment and just literally, you know, they've heard about their friends that might have had induction, but they don't really understand the process of it, can you quickly just take us through the kind of stages of induction so people know what we're talking about and what they should expect if they're going to go down that road?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a multitude of reasons why somebody might be offered an induction. In fact, it's pretty impossible not to be offered an induction unless you give birth at 38 weeks, to be honest. Otherwise, you're going to get offered an induction at some point. An induction is a process to kickstart labour before you spontaneously go into labour. So you're kind of forcing the body to do something that it wasn't quite ready to do. And because of that, how long it takes and whether it works and how many stages into the induction process you go will vary depending on the person and at what point you have the induction. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I mean, a sweep is the first stage of induction. And I think a lot of people don't realise that because they will get offered a sweep strictly speaking, it's supposed to be 39 weeks, according to NICE guidelines, which changed at the beginning of this year, which I personally think is premature. But that is the first stage of induction. And I think people don't realise it's induction because the midwife will say, well, let's just give you a sweep. And get things going, and then you'll avoid induction. And that the way presenting it in that way makes you think that you're avoiding being induced because you're having a sweep, and it might naturally, I'm using like air quotes here, naturally kickstart labor. But it is a form of induction because the whole point of doing a sweep is to induce labor before you spontaneously go into labor. And it's not as innocuous as everybody thinks it is or makes out. Some of the side effects of a sweep, and by the way, a sweep is when the midwife puts finger up the vagina through the cervix and either massages or sweeps the membranes to separate the amniotic sac from the cervix, and it's to stimulate prostaglandins and try and stimulate contractions. And some of the risks of this are that it can cause stop-start contractions in a longer labour because you are trying to force the body to do something that it wasn't quite ready to do. And that sounds like it's not a big issue, but if you have a really long labour because you've kick-started it artificially, and then you're exhausted and your baby's exhausted and then your baby gets in distress or you feel like you can't cope because you're exhausted, that can have an impact, and that can cause a cascade of other medical intervention. So presenting it as this kind of routine, innocuous thing that we do, I think is really dangerous because the risks of sweeps are rarely discussed, I think. And you're not even asked sometimes if you want it. It's kind of hop on the bed while you're here, we'll give you a sweep. And I think that's really coercive.
Yeah, I think that sort of assumptive language that we've both mentioned already, like we'll just put you in next week, or hop on the bed and we'll just do a quick one now. I always would advise people, if you hear that sort of assumptive language, just to pause and be like, well, actually, can I just have a think about this, and I'll come back to you tomorrow, and just get yourself out of there so you can actually just take some time to think, because that language can be so pressurizing in itself.
Yeah, and to be honest, with induction, you do have the luxury of time to step away and make a decision whether you want to go ahead with an induction or not, because it's not life or death in this moment. If it was, then they'd be wheeling you into theatre for a C-section. They wouldn't be booking you in for an induction in a week's time. With a sweep, it's not urgent. I mean, you can say, I'm going to go home and have a think, or can I have half an hour to think, or can we do it at my next appointment if I want to go ahead, if you don't want to do it straight away.
And you mentioned that it's kind of routinely offered from about 39 weeks. So we've got to have a talk about 39 weeks, 40 weeks, 41 weeks, mm-hmm. this illusion of a due date. Would you let people know, how many babies come on their due date? What are we really playing with here? And maybe should we move away from having a due date and having due windows and taking the pressure off? What's your opinion on that whole piece?
I mean, we used to have due months. Our grandmothers would have been given a due month, and actually it makes far more sense than pinning your due date on a specific date. The way we calculate due dates is archaic. It's hundreds of years old. It's not accurate. I mean, there's a whole load of assumptions in there. And one of the biggest assumptions is that babies are ready to be born at 40 weeks. And a lot of them are not. You know, the fact that 81% of babies are born after 40 weeks, so the majority of babies are born after 40 weeks, just screams the fact that the way we calculate due dates is not right, because it's not the average. And I think there is real fear-mongering around going overdue or going past 40 weeks. And the mention of stillbirth gets bandied around like it's an inevitable thing if you go past 40 weeks. And there is some research, there are some studies that show there is an incremental increase in the risk of stillbirth the longer your pregnancy is. But I think what's really important is that we quantify what that risk is. And actually, the risk is really, really small. I mean, we're talking about less than single digit figures here in terms of percentages of risk of stillbirth. That's not to say that it won't happen. You know, no one can ever guarantee that you'll avoid a poor outcome or an unfortunate outcome when it comes to pregnancy. But banding about the word stillbirth and playing on a pregnant person's worst fears and not quantifying what that risk is, I think, is really, really wrong. And then not balancing it with the risks of induction as well, because it has risks. You need to know what the risks are on both options, waiting for spontaneous labor or going ahead with an induction, in order to make an informed decision. And, you know, due dates is one of the most common reasons for recommending an induction, but you know, and you know, we say 39 weeks, but I did a poll on my Instagram, I think it was a few months ago, asking people at what point they were offered an induction or what point they were offered a sweep, and there was people saying 37 weeks, you know, 36 weeks. I mean, one person said she was offered a sweep at 37 weeks because there was no benefit to keep the baby in any longer after that.
Wow, she was actually told that.
Yeah.
So I was watching something else on Instagram, and it was a really good point. It was where people are kind of told this sort of emotive stuff. And then the advice was actually just to ask the person saying that kind of thing to just, could you please put it in writing for me? Could you pop it in an email and I'll take that home and consider it? Because you're not going to get that emotive pressure in an email. You can ask for your facts and figures then, can't you? Can you just put all the statistics in, the risks on both sides, and then I can actually weigh that up? And it buys you a bit of time, but it also means that the professional that's meant to be, you know, caring for you is going to not load it with that emotional stuff. I thought was a great suggestion.
Yeah, it's a really good suggestion. And I think digesting stats and figures and, you know, statistics is hard. And the way they're presented also can still be coercive. You know, I mean, it is a minefield when it comes to, you know, working out research and statistics, which is probably why I post so much research and stats, because it's, again, it probably plays back to my old job, because I used to, you know, with the marketing, I used to do a lot of statistics and reporting, and presenting things in a way that is fair and, you know, easy to understand is not, you know, it's not easy.
So the classic one is about you know, the risk of infection doubling once your waters have gone, and your risk of infection, can you remember what that stat is? The risk of infection, and it's like it doubles, the risk of infection doubles, and that sounds really dramatic, but actually I think the number is really tiny, isn't it? It's like 0.03% or something that changes to 0.06, but the way you present that data with the wording could really change someone's feeling about what they're thinking they might want to do.
Yeah, because there's multiple different ways that you can present information. You can say that the risk is doubled, but then is it doubling from 1% to 2% or 50% to 100%? Like, that matters. Or saying there's you know, a sixfold increase in something, but not saying what the actual statistic is. Like, I think, you know, saying there is a 3% chance of something happening, but then there's a 99.7% chance it's not going to happen. You know, so we might talk about a 0.3% chance of stillbirth. That might still sound really scary to somebody. But when you actually say the opposite and you say, but there's a 99.7% chance you're not going to have a stillbirth, well, that actually doesn't sound so scary anymore. So I think it's really important that even when we are being given information around statistics and around induction and around stillbirth, that we're still mindful how that information is being presented, because it can still be biased or it can still be coloured in a certain way or said in a certain way to achieve a certain response. And I think we need to be aware of that.
Yeah. So do you think there needs to be more distinction between an offer of a of an induction or a recommendation? You know, is there any discussion of your care options if you choose not to induce? So could they then support someone not choosing to induce with daily monitoring or other things if they're quite worried about it? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think that offer is a word that is used very often when it comes to induction. It is pretty much we strongly recommend, or we recommend, or we will. Like, quite often it's not recommend, it's we will book you in. And if you decline, it's, well, if we don't get you in diary, then, you know, then there might not be any space and then we can't do your induction. So we'll just book it in and you can cancel it later.
And then that goes on someone's notes, like induction declined in big letters, which looks like then the onus is on that person for declining. So then they've got responsibility for everything that happens because they've declined. It feels kind of, again, loaded.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's just, I think it is, it can be quite pressured, I think, when it comes to the discussion around induction, particularly if you'd want to decline an induction. Mm. And yes, they can offer daily monitoring, they can offer, you know, extra appointments. And if that makes you feel more comfortable with declining induction because you really don't want to go ahead with an induction, then absolutely, that's a really good option. I would say that you do have to be prepared, though, to repeatedly have those conversations. At each time you go in, they're probably going to try and persuade you to go ahead with the induction. And I think, you know, some people who are very firm in their opinions and they really don't want to go ahead of induction because they don't think it's the right choice will eventually cave, or the resolve will crumble, just because they're being bombarded every time they go in to go and get monitored. They're having to have those conversations, which can be exhausting. And it chips away at their resolve. I'm not saying that people shouldn't go in for daily monitoring, but I do think that you need to be aware that, you know, those discussions may happen repeatedly and you need to be kind of mentally prepared for that as well.
And I think it's good to circle back to your point that if we were genuinely worried that something was seriously wrong with mum or the baby, we would just be going into theatre and having a caesarean. So, you know, kind of why are we doing this? Another point that's interesting, you know, we're kind of talking about the air quotes innocuous sweeps, but then you've kind of also got the, you know, the natural ways that people can kind of induce. Again, I'm doing a lot of air quotes that people won't be able to see, you know, having sex and trying to keep the sperm near the cervix, eating a truckload of pineapples, having curry, going for acupuncture, all this other stuff. I remember going to a talk by Michelle O'Donne, you know, the famous French obstetrician, and he was quite interesting because he said, you know, it might not be a medical induction. It might be that you're trying to naturally induce things along, but either way, you are asking the body and the baby to do something before they're necessarily ready. And this needs to be borne in mind. So I just wanted to raise that because I think that's a piece that people think isn't included in this discussion because they're doing it, air quotes, naturally. But if you're still trying to nudge things along, you're still trying to nudge things along.
Yeah, it's a valid point. And I think particularly somebody who's really stressed about going overdue or really wanting to avoid induction, they can go hell for leather, you know, bouncing on their birthing ball and going for long walks and walking up and down the stairs and doing all of these things. And all you're doing really is stressing yourself out, which is probably going to prolong your pregnancy, to be honest, when actually you should probably just be chilling out, getting the oxytocin up, just enjoying and savouring the last few days and weeks before baby arrives and just let nature take its course.
That's so interesting, the way you phrase that. You know, they're worried and stressed about going overdue or being induced. So if we were to try to actually solve that as a problem, maybe we do need to get rid of due dates and get rid of conversations about recommendations of induction, unless it's a very serious issue that someone's experiencing that means it's really medically warranted, rather than just this sort of slightly more spurious conversation about dates.
This is the problem, though, because like I said earlier, it is virtually impossible not to get offered an induction, and it's not just due dates that determine, you know, that you have, and again, I'm doing air quotes now, a medical reason for induction, because a lot of the reasons that we are given to justify induction are questionable.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
There is a long list. I mean, so when I teach my classes, I spend an entire hour on induction in my course, which I didn't used to, but I had to add it in because everybody's been offered an induction. And one of the slides, one of the questions that I ask my clients is, what reasons can you think of that you might be offered an induction? And I've got a long list of reasons. And 50, 60% of the time, people think up new ones that haven't got on the slide. Because there is just, it's an endless list, and you know, an endless list of reasons. I mean, the most common ones are things like maternal age. You know, if you're over 35, you're classed as a geriatric pregnancy, which is insulting, or advanced maternal age, both pretty horrible terms. And the research behind that, again, is questionable because it's old research, it's outdated, there are assumptions made there. And even looking at the research and the statistics, yes, there is a small increase in risk over 35 and then over 40. But again, it's a really small risk. And actually, maternal health maybe is a better indication than age. Gestational diabetes is a really common one that people get told, you have gestational diabetes, therefore you need an induction.
Now that's a really interesting one, though, Erin, because, you know, I've been teaching for like 17 years, and about 8 or so years ago, maybe 10 years ago, they changed the level that someone would then be classified as having gestational diabetes. They brought it down. So overnight in my classes, a lot of people suddenly were being classified as having gestational diabetes that literally the week before would not have had it. And then that meant that that was going to impact and change how they were going to be talked to, monitored, spoke, you know, how their births were going to unfold. And it was very interesting because, like, for 10 years, they, you know, they wouldn't have been classified, but overnight, because they changed the parameters, they've now all had to change, you know, how their births are going to unfold. And we put a label on it.
I think that's indicative of pretty much all guidelines in maternity care. There is a trend to move the goalposts, and everything is getting more and more restrictive, where it's really hard to not be, you know, fit a tick box to get to mark you as high risk. You know, you were talking about the risk of infection if your waters break. I mean, those guidelines have changed over the years. It used to be, you know, induce after 72 hours.
Yes, it did.
And then 42 hours. Then when I had Daisy and my waters broke, the guideline at the time was to induce after 24 hours. Now the guideline is to induce immediately or within 24 hours, which again is another reason for induction that's given, which again is questionable. I mean, being black, you know, not being white, you know, actually isn't in guidelines to induce, although they wanted to put it in and there was such an uproar that they didn't. But the damage is done. Like, we know that people are being offered inductions because they're not white, because apparently, you know, well, I say apparently, I mean, we know that black and brown babies and mothers have higher percentage risk of morbidity. That's not because they're genetically predisposed to it, though. You know, that's because they are treated differently. They are not listened to. They are gaslit. They are withheld drugs and pain relief. Therefore, inducing people because they are not white is not a medical reason for induction. And it's also really racist because they are not addressing the reason, the root cause of why people are dying giving birth and why babies are dying. So rather than looking at the cultural and the racist roots of that, let's just induce everybody earlier. You know, there's so many different reasons. I mean, I get people, you know, I've had so many clients being told your placenta's going to pack up.
That's another one that comes up, isn't it? You've gone over your dates, your placenta's going to pack up. Let's unpack that a bit, because I think that's another big red card that chips away at the most determined people. What do you make of that then, Erin?
Well, I mean, so I've just published a podcast episode with Sophie Messager, who's a medical researcher and a doula. And she has probably the most popular article on the myth of the aging placenta. And she updated it prior to our podcast episode, because she'd written that article quite a long time ago, and she thought, let me just go back and check in if there's any new research to see if my article still stands. And she said it does. There are reasons that a placenta will calcify, and it's not necessarily because it is going to pack up. There are reasons that and signs that the placenta changes throughout pregnancy and near the end of pregnancy, but it can be completely normal. You know, the assumption that all placentas are going to stop working, you know, like clockwork after a certain point is absurd. But it is, I mean, it is given as a reason. And when people ask, well, can you show me the research? I mean, one of my clients got told, well, I haven't got any. It's anecdotal. She was like, well, how can you make a recommendation to do something when you haven't got any evidence to back it up?
Well, one of the ladies that responded to one of my posts about induction, and it created quite a big conversation amongst lots of people, and she shared that she was told by her doctor that he would rather induce 999 women than see one stillbirth. And he actually said mm-hmm. that to her in an appointment. And I'm just thinking, so you'd rather have 999 women potentially experience birth trauma from the cascade of intervention that might unfold. I just couldn't believe that that was said in an appointment, or that that's where he's coming from.
I can, though, because that's where the NICE guidelines have been written from. You know, there's the Cochrane study looking at induction showed that we would need to induce 426 women and birthing people to prevent one stillbirth. And that's essentially the same thing as what that doctor is saying. And of course, I mean, naturally, of course, we want to avoid and want to prevent as many stillbirths as possible. But it doesn't matter how restrictive the guidelines get. It doesn't matter how much we over-medicalize birth. You are never, ever, ever going to prevent all stillbirths. Because some of them unfortunately happen because it's life and death. It's the circle of life. Some babies will pass and we will never know why. And I think it's really important to understand that there is real harm and real damage being caused by over-medicalizing birth and over-inducing people. You know, and that's not something to underestimate or ignore.
So what do you wish people knew about how induction differs from spontaneous labour? You know, what can we shine a light on there? If we aren't attached to our due dates, if we're patient, if we're healthy, if we're well, we've been well all the way through pregnancy, maybe avoiding any sort of scaremongering at the end, you know, that last scan that goes, your baby's big or your baby's small. And, you know, that last one that's just come in since COVID, that's probably the one that I feel most strongly about at the moment that creates a lot of discourse afterwards. But if we can really trust where we're at and go for a spontaneous labour, what would you love people to know about how those births can unfold?
I mean, a spontaneous labour versus an induction are not the same. I mean, generally people don't experience them the same. You know, a spontaneous labour for the vast majority of people, be a gradual build-up in intensity of contractions. When we induce, we are forcing the body to do something that it wasn't quite ready to do. And therefore, it can take a really long time. So you can end up with a much longer labour, potentially, particularly if we're doing induction earlier. You know, if we're doing an induction at 42 weeks, you know, it may happen quite quickly because the body was probably fairly ready to go into labour by that point. We do it at 39 weeks. It's probably going to take a lot longer because the baby's just not ready and your body wasn't really ready to go into labour. And that means that you may end up with multiple steps of induction. You know, for example, when we use synthetic oxytocin to induce contractions, that's literally like a sledgehammer to force your body to go into contracting. Very hard and very fast contractions very quickly, which can overlap, which means that you don't get a break in between your contractions, which you would if you were going into spontaneous labour. It also means that your baby doesn't get a break in between contractions. And that's important because with spontaneous labour, your baby is getting squeezed by those contractions, by the uterus, and then the contraction eases off and your baby gets a chance to recover, which means their heart rate drops when they're having a contraction and then it recovers after each contraction, which is why the midwife wants to listen to your baby after each contraction near the end of labour to make sure that your baby's heart rate is recovering in between so that they're not in distress. When we don't have a break in between contractions, your baby doesn't get a chance to recover in between those contractions. So we know that there is a link between having synthetic oxytocin and further medical interventions like having an episiotomy or an instrumental birth or an unplanned C-section because your baby's in distress. And that's because it's stressful for the baby to go through the induction process.
And it might be making you contract, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to dilate.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Also true. My own personal experience of induction, and, you know, everybody goes through induction differently. But I had pessary. I think I had 2 doses of pessary.
So just listening, the pessary is the next stage after you have the sweep. You'd be offered a pessary. Yeah. Tell everyone about a pessary, Erin.
Pessary is synthetic prostaglandins. Mm-hmm. There are 2 different types typically that they use, which is either Prostin or Propess. Prostin is a gel or a tablet and Propess is a pessary, which they push up towards your cervix as close as possible to try and get your cervix to efface and dilate. I had a couple of doses of those. I don't know at which point I had the epidural. It might have been before or after the synthetic oxytocin, but I'd also had synthetic oxytocin. And it was extremely uncomfortable. And, you know, obviously I've given birth 3 times, so I do have something to compare this to. Mm-hmm. You know, I had opiates and I had an epidural with my first. With my second, I just used the pull. I didn't use gas and air. I didn't use anything else apart from just using the pull. And the same with my son because I had a home birth. And it's not a case of me wanting to be a hero and, you know, not use drugs. I genuinely coped fine just using breathing techniques and using the warm water. And my experience of labour and how those sensations felt and how those contractions felt were night and day compared to my first. So in my own personal experience, an induction, it's completely different from a spontaneous labour. The sensations and the intensity of those sensations are completely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really interesting and good for people to know for sure. So after, again, let's maybe carry on through the stages. So if people are listening to this fresh and, you know, they're learning about induction, we've talked about sweep, we've talked about pessary. I guess the idea would be that just instigates labour, contractions start, happy days, let's get the baby out. But if that doesn't then work, what would be the next stage for someone on that induction journey?
Well, I mean, even if it does work, I think one thing that is not made clear with the pessary is the whole goal is to dilate you enough to break your waters.
You're right, that is not made clear.
Yeah. It's the point is to dilate you enough so that they can break your waters. And so artificial rupture of membranes is the next stage of labour. And that's where they use something called an amni hook, which looks a bit like a crochet hook, which they pass up your vagina and through your cervix, and then they break your waters. And that enables the baby's head to press against the top of the cervix and stimulate quite intense contractions. Again, has risks. Mm-hmm. It can be extremely uncomfortable. Your contractions are very likely to ramp up quite intensely after that point. Spontaneously or artificially ruptured membranes are probably going to intensify your contractions. But it's also an infection risk. And actually, by the way, a lot of these induction methods, one of the risks is infection, because we are pushing things up through the cervix into the uterus, and potentially pushing harmful bacteria up there as well. Mm-hmm. When we break the waters, baby's no longer protected by the amniotic sac, so they're exposed to all of that bacteria.
And just to kind of give people a different sort of perspective, I just saw and read a brilliant home birth story. I think she was free birthing, so she was being like super autonomous about what she was doing, and there was a beautiful point in her story where she could feel the baby's head, and she instinctively felt like she needed to break her own waters. So she put her own fingers up and pressed on the sac, which just released straight away. And then her baby was born in a couple of pushes. So I just wanted to share that, because if you're in the moment and that's what you really feel you want to have happen, like, trust your instincts, mama, because they're on full power, aren't they? So just to add that in as a little segue.
Yeah. Yeah, we should definitely listen to our instincts. We suppress it and we ignore our instincts.
And I think the whole process is kind of designed for that, really, isn't it? You know, just from getting the due date confirmed after the first appointment, and then kind of being scheduled for all these, you know, appointments. Some of them are very valid and needed, but some maybe less so. We kind of, you know, there's some people out there at the moment talking about how women are groomed through the pregnancy process so that we have less autonomy when we get to the end, because we've kind of outsourced our own our knowing, rather than going inward to find out what we feel. You know, how's my baby, how's my body? We're outsourcing it at every step of the way to get external validation, which probably, you know, carries on for lots of people in the birth space.
Yeah, and I think grooming is a really good word, actually, because I think pregnant people are groomed from even preconception. You know, we're groomed from a very young age to fear birth and to fear the process and to behave and to do what we're told and to not ask questions and to, implicitly trust our care providers. You know,
be a good girl, be nice, be polite, don't rock the boat.
Yeah. And then once we are pregnant, you know, I hear it all the time. You know, people say my midwife's so lovely and she's so nice, and I'm sure she is. I'm not saying that all midwives are awful. They're not. You know, there's some fantastic midwives out there, but we are also groomed from right at the beginning of pregnancy. You know, I've had clients who have had induction discussed at their booking appointment. You know, how many pregnant people have home birth discussed at their booking appointment? Hardly any. You know, we are very obstetric led from a very, very early on point in pregnancy. And we are groomed to go to hospital and give birth at the right time. With the support of medical staff and drugs.
I think this is a point Claire and I talk about quite a lot. It's like pregnancy is first and foremost a physiological event, you know, like weeing, pooing, having your period, vomiting when you've got an upset tummy, you know, giving birth is something your body wants to do of its own accord at the right time when it's needed. And the whole kind of conversation and system is set up to teach everyone that being pregnant, giving birth, having periods or not having periods when you're younger is a medical event. You know, it relies on medical practices. And actually, I think that paradigm needs to switch back to us, you know, understanding our bodies, that this is a physiological event.
Yeah, I think there's a real push to standardize standardized birth, right? And birth is not standard. It's spontaneous. It's different in every single person. And I think trying to standardize something as spontaneous and, you know, changeable and unique as birth, I think it causes a lot of problems.
And you can kind of see where, you know, the medical practitioners are coming from. You know, they want to try and standardize it to offer a level of care en masse to a huge population with a limited budget, so that people with real medical issues and needs don't get missed. You know, I do get that, but we're kind of making everyone go along with something that might not be right for the majority. And when you like mentioned birth trauma right at the beginning, what are we seeing there? Something like 300,000 women a year coming through with birth trauma.
Yes, it's 30,000 people a year ending up with birth trauma and PTSD. And the biggest cause of death of new mothers and new parents in the first year after giving birth is suicide.
That's just heartbreaking.
It's the biggest cause of death, and it's because, part of it is because we don't have a village, we don't have people looking after us mm-hmm. and supporting us after we give birth, and there's a societal belief that we just get back, you know, get back to normal and, you know, get on with things, and so we just flounder around struggling without having the proper place on our own. And also so many people are being horrifically traumatized by their birth experiences.
And then gaslit afterwards that, you know, no, you get on, it's okay. Let's just put this under the carpet.
Yeah. Well, because the people that are causing the trauma don't have to deal with you after you've given birth. You never see those people again. And then, unfortunately, mental health services have been so underfunded and been shut down that people are waiting far too long to actually get the support that they need after they give birth.
Yeah, you've also got that extra piece in there, haven't you, that, you know, to sort of reflect that back, the people that are causing the trauma are also the ones that are saving the day at the end with the cesarean. So kind of you've got that part of the conversation where people then are grateful to the system and the people that have caused the trauma. We've got this really crazy negative feedback loop that ends in women feeling like that wasn't quite right, but I have no idea why that wasn't quite right, because they've been so gaslit about it the whole way through.
I think this is a problem that I think a lot of people who have a really traumatic birth and will say things like, thank God I was in hospital, I would have died otherwise. There's so much context around their birth that they are missing. They don't realize that in a lot of circumstances it's the hospital that caused that cascade, and that is the reason why they've ended up with such a traumatic experience and needed those life-saving interventions. Mm-hmm. And then you know, obviously they will share those experiences to other people and other pregnant people, and you know, as a way of justifying the, you know, the medical interventions that happened. And this is why we have this societal belief that birth is so dangerous, and we need to have the safety net of hospital and drugs and, you know, a theatre nearby in case things go wrong, when actually, ironically, you know, if more people birthed at home, we probably wouldn't have the rates of intervention and emergency C-sections that we have now. But people are too scared, and they're too I'm going to say brainwashed, to be honest, to believe, you know, to feel comfortable of considering an alternative place to give birth or just to wait for labour to start spontaneously.
So if we're going to try to think about, you know, most people that are fairly healthy, low risk pregnancies, fairly healthy babies, you know, they're preparing for their birth, what kind of things would you suggest that they do in pregnancy and as part of their birth planning, or who's in their birth team? What would be like your top five suggestions to help someone not only just have a positive and informed choice birth, you know, an empowering birth, but actually help them, you know, stack their odds in their favour that they could avoid induction and have a smooth, let's use the word smoother, a smoother, less complicated, unmedicalized, physiological birth process, because that's kind of what most people want. So what do they need to do to kind of help them get that?
One thing I want to say before I start listing off my five things is that, yes, obviously we want to avoid induction. Sometimes induction is potentially medically necessary, and I think there are things that we can do to make that a positive experience. And I think some of the things that I'm going to say will help with that.
Right.
My first tip would be to get yourself a doula if you can afford it. I know it's not in everyone's budget. However, if you can reprioritize your spending and not get that really expensive buggy, or not spend loads of money on decorating the nursery that your child is probably not going to sleep in for the first 6 to 12 months anyway.
Some cases.
Yeah, or ever. I had a good one for Daisy and she actually never slept in it, like ever. She just co-slept. And she's 8 and she's still sleeping in my bed. So I would say reprioritize your spending where you can and get yourself a doula. And then you have that continuity of care with somebody that is, you know, hopefully familiar and you feel comfortable with, mm-hmm. who is going to be completely on your side, not bound by guidelines and policies, and is extremely knowledgeable to support you throughout birth.
And I'll just jump in and just say guidelines and policies are just that, guidelines and policies. It's not the law. You have choice.
Exactly. The second thing I would say is go and do a good hypnobirthing course. I'm going to say hypnobirthing over and above an antenatal course. And that's just because I've got clients who are doing both hypnobirthing courses with me, which is an antenatal course, by the way. And they're doing antenatal courses, you know, whatever big name brand or small antenatal courses. And it's interesting because I am horrified by some of the things that they are being told in their antenatal classes. Whether it's an antenatal teacher or a midwife, you know, some of the stuff is really biased or it's just plain wrong. I would say doing a hypnobirthing course is better because you've got a better chance of having a more balanced conversation and balanced information in a hypnobirthing course, and you are benefiting from getting all of the hypnobirthing side of things and the coping techniques and the tools that you will not get with an antenatal class. So obviously I think doing a live course with me or somebody like me is, I think, the best thing that you can do. But if you can't afford that, then people want. if you can't do that, then at bare minimum go follow Instagram accounts of people that are going to be able to give you information in a balanced and fair way.
What we'll do, Erin, if it's okay, we'll tap you up for like 4 or 5 of your top recommended Instagram accounts that you love as well as your own, and we'll pop all of that in the show notes for people so they can easily access that.
Yeah, that would be good, because I was going to say that also, you know, just going and following a load of well-known midwives on Instagram, some of them are fantastic, some of them are, I'm going to say, problematic. You really need to be careful who you're following on social media, just because they are a qualified midwife or a well-known antenatal expert, it does not mean that they are free from bias. Some of them are very, very institutionalized, and they are brainwashing, it's very, very problematic. So yeah, I will share some accounts to suggest which you can accompany the episode.
That would be great. Thank you.
My third thing would be get your birth partner on board and educated with you, mm-hmm. because it's fantastic if you've got all the knowledge in your head, but the minute you go into labor and you're in the thick of it, you're not going to want to or be capable of doing all that advocating and speaking up for yourself and, you know, remembering everything. You need a birth partner that is going to be able to do that confidently for you. And if they haven't attended a course with you, or they haven't done any reading and they don't know what the hell's going on,
yeah,
you're not getting the support that you deserve. So I would say make sure your birth partner is well educated and supported. 4, I would say, is understand what your rights are, because you have rights. And I think a lot of people are misinformed when it comes to rights in pregnancy and birth. I've had so many people, I've had clients go, oh, but free birth is illegal. No, it's not. I'm not saying go and have a free birth. You know, I'm not saying go and have an unassisted birth with no medical staff, but it is legal. And there are midwives out there telling people that it's against the law, and it's not. You are allowed to decline anything. No one is allowed to put anything on your body or in your body without your consent, as long as you are awake and able to make a conscious decision to consent or decline. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important.
And it's the maternity health service. It's there to provide a service to you should you wish to mm-hmm. accept that offer of a service.
Exactly. And we don't, you know, we're not confused when it comes to the GP prescribing antibiotics for a sore throat. No one's going to force them down your throat if you don't want to take them. We choose whether we want to or not. We choose whether we want to get vaccinated or not. Just because you're pregnant, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden you have to submit to everything that's offered. You don't. You can engage as much or as little as you want with maternity care.
From our yoga perspective, there's a term that we would encourage, and it's about being discerning. You know, like being discerning. Don't just do what you think you should or shouldn't do. Like, really check in, do your research. Like you were saying, find the risks on both sides, find the benefits on both sides, and then really be discerning about what's right for you.
Yeah. And I think that would be my 5th thing, actually, is, you know, ask questions and literally start from a blank page. You know, forget everything that you think you know about being pregnant and giving birth and start from scratch. Have no assumptions, because so many of our assumptions when it comes to birth are misinformed and they are wrong. You know, prime example is people, first time pregnant people, you know, just discounting home birth without doing any research, without understanding the benefits, and assuming that it's dangerous for first time mothers. Not the case, you know, but lots of people don't even consider it.
Yeah.
So I would say start from scratch, ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions. And I know how, and learn how to ask the right questions as well, you know. But I teach all of my clients the BRAINS acronym, which is ask what the benefits are, the risks, alternatives, use your instinct, ask what if we do nothing, ask for the science, and if you can't get that, ask for a second opinion.
Right. And then ask for all of that to be put in writing. Oh, so we've got another question here, Erin, just about, you know, when people are high risk for various reasons, it can sometimes feel a bit of a kind of blanket term. Have you got any thoughts that you would like to share with that? If there's somebody listening that's now high risk and that means they've got to do X, Y, and Z, what would you like to say to those people?
I think it can be really scary if you get labelled as high risk. I think it's really important that it's not a tick boxing exercise. Tick, you're black, tick, you're older, tick, you have gestational diabetes, therefore you have to do X, Y, Z. They should be treating you as an individual. Personally, I would ask for an appointment with a consultant midwife and get an individualized care plan in place, so that the consultant midwife is there to try and, you know, look at you as a unique individual pregnant person, and see how can we get you the birth that you want and deserve in a safe manner. And obviously I think everybody should have that, but particularly if you have risk factors, I would go and ask to speak to the consultant midwife, you know, quite, because otherwise, if you don't, quite often you're labeled as high risk, and then it's like you can't have a water birth, you can't use the birthing center, you can't have a home birth. And actually it's not the case. You just have to push for it and ask for kind of special circumstances or exceptions to be made, or contingency plans to be put in place.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking to a consultant midwife will help with that, I think.
That's really, really good. Really good advice. Thank you. And then I was going to circle back round, because we kind of touched on when things quite don't go when things don't quite go right and people are left feeling, you know, upset or at worst traumatized, what would your suggestions be to those people? How can we help afterwards?
My first suggestion would be to ask for a debrief, to go through. So request your birth notes from your hospital. The process is slightly different depending on the hospital, but they should be, all hospitals have to give you your notes, and they all have them in a digital format. So you ask for your birth notes is the first thing, and then find someone to give you a debrief. Personally, I would get someone independent to do your debrief rather than going back to the hospital where you gave birth, because that can be re-traumatizing, and potentially they're not going to be as honest and open about the you know, the mistakes or the reasons that things happened, because they're culpable. So finding an independent birth worker or an independent midwife to do your debrief, I think, is a good idea. And then seek out support to process that trauma. I think unprocessed trauma, it can stay with you forever, and it can affect all aspects of your life and your relationship. So I think it's really important to go and get help if you do feel like you need it. There's lots of people who do trauma therapies and three-step rewind courses, or I personally would recommend going and...
Yeah, we both do it. Me and Claire both do it, and we can do it on Zoom for people. So wherever you are, if you need to do that check-in, we're here.
Yeah, I know some fantastic psychologists, but I think seek out support from somebody so that you process that trauma and talk about it, because internalizing it is not, I don't think it is not healthy. It can come out in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah, and I think just on a sort of physical, element, if our bodies have been through a lot physically, we might need some help. So go see a women's health physio, book that appointment in, get your pelvic floor, your perineum, your C-section, whatever it is, just get it all checked. Again, get that sort of personalised plan to help you recover physically, because, you know, we've got that side as well, haven't we, that we might be recovering from. Got another question for you. So, you know, we're all about informed choice. I know you are too, and that's why we use the BRAIN acronym. And of course, there's going to be some incidences where people actually do make an informed choice to have an induction. So what do you think they could do to try to make that experience as positive as possible?
There's a few things. First off, make sure you are totally on board with the idea of going for that induction, and make sure you have asked all the questions and you understand very clearly the risks and benefits of each stage of induction that they might offer you, and which ones you want and which ones you don't. Mm-hmm. I would say have a realistic view of how long induction can take. Because I think a lot of people go in for an induction and think they're going to be home in 24 hours, and then they're horrified when they're still there 3 days later and they're still on the pessary. And actually, you might go in for an induction and it might not even start for 24, 48 hours because there's just a queue ahead of you. I think understanding all the things that we talk about in hypnobirthing, the importance of the birth environment, and all of those tools and techniques to boost oxytocin are going to be so vital if you are having an induction, because you want your body to be helping that induction process along. And quite frankly, from my experience of going to induction wards, they are not designed to facilitate oxytocin. They are sterile. They are very medicalized. They are bright. They are noisy. You have no privacy. So what is within your power to adapt that environment to make it more birth friendly and more oxytocin friendly is really, really important as well. Because otherwise you're not giving your body the best chance of getting that induction to work. I think those would be my top tips for induction.
So that might mean, you know, affecting the environment, see if you can get the lights turned down, bring your own playlist, have some of those little tea light candles that can flicker, get your partner to give you some nice massage, ask for some private time and you can just get cuddly on the bed. Bring your favourite blanket that smells of home, you know, all that kind of stuff. Could all really help, couldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, take headphones with you, because you can't play your own music if you're in a ward with, you know, three other people.
Yeah.
Take an eye mask with you, because if you're in a ward, you can't switch the lights off, because it's not your room. So just be mindful that you might not have the privacy that you want because you're on a ward. Mm-hmm. So thinking about how you can achieve all of those things, but in a setting where you don't have control over everything in that room.
Yeah, that's brilliant, Erin. Thank you so much. So if there's any big message you'd like to share to anyone listening to us today, anything else maybe that we haven't quite touched on, what might be your key message at the moment that you'd like to share with people?
I think my key message is, it's always the same message, is to just not go into birth blind, do some prep. You know, what that prep is, and whether it's just preparing your body, or whether it's, you know, knowledge or doing a birth plan, do something. Don't go into birth completely blind and unprepared, because that is a very easy shortcut to having a negative experience.
Yeah. And at the end of our podcast, we'd love to ask all our guests a few questions. One of them, Erin, is, what are you grateful for right now in your life?
I'm always grateful for health, because I think it's such a precious thing. So I'm grateful that I'm healthy. I'm grateful that my family are healthy, because I think all the material things are great, but you can't buy health.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I'm grateful for.
Oh, same. And we also have an idea here that, you know, our babies, our children, either the birth process itself or just being with our children later, that, you know, we change, we learn, we develop, we reflect. So we sort of phrase that in a way that our babies kind of bring us these gifts, these realizations. And we were just wondering if you think your babies have taught you anything. Did they bring any gifts?
Oh, so many. I'm a completely different person now than I was before I had kids. Having children completely and utterly changes you, I think. I think having children has made me less selfish. And that's not to say I was a really selfish person before, but you don't have the luxury so much of being selfish when you're a mother. And they've definitely brought me patience as well, which sometimes wears thin. when it's, you know, morning through one, and then I'm like, just put your shoes on, can you just hurry up? But yeah, they've definitely brought me patience, and made me a less selfish, more thoughtful person, I think.
Oh, hold them tight, give them big squidges. Oh, and our final question, we really love the guilty feminists. I'm a feminist, but, and then they come out with the funniest honest truths and sometimes hypocrisies about that are just really great. So we wanted to kind of match it up. So maybe for you it might be, I'm a hypnobirthing teacher, but would you like to dispel any myths or share an honest truth?
I share this with all of my clients, so I'm not scared to share this one, because when I teach I always talk about pelvic health and doing your pelvic floor exercises. I'm an antenatal instructor, but I do not do my pelvic floor exercises.
Naughty.
But I am quite open about the facts, because, and I think it's a really good example of why you should do them, because I have three kids. I quite often, and I drink, can I swear?
I'm not, shed loads.
Shed loads. In fact, it's the only thing that I do drink. And sometimes I really need a wee. And my, you know, one child needs a snack and somebody else needs them to wipe their bum. And, you know, they're all calling me in different directions. And then I'll sneeze and I'll be like, oh, I should have just gone to the toilet when I needed to. Oh. Because, you know, just a little bit comes out and you have an accident. And it's because I don't do my pelvic floor exercises. And I've had three children, naturally. So do your pelvic floor exercises because it's very
important. Oh, well, we talk a lot about sneeze wheeze in our postnatal yoga classes. And maybe you could come along one day and come and just join in for some pregnancy yoga and postnatal yoga and come and check out what we do. You might really enjoy the pelvic floor stuff that we share. Would you like to just quickly tell us what you've got coming up?
Yes, yeah, sure. So I'm very excited to be speaking at the Association of Radical Midwives annual conference next month in November. I'll be talking to a whole conference load of midwives and student midwives and birth workers about the impact of maternity culture on supporting physiological birth and the challenges that midwives experience and how they can facilitate physiological birth in the current maternity system. So that's what I'll be speaking about, which is very, very exciting.
Amazing, amazing. We wish you all the best with that. We can't wait to hear how it all goes. And I'm sure they're going to absolutely love and appreciate everything you're doing too. So yeah, big well done on that. That's amazing. Erin, as usual, it's been absolutely brilliant having you on our podcast. Thank you so much for your time, your energy, your information, the amount of research you've put into all of your work, for being out there, for being brave, for shining a light on this kind of quite meaty subject. So yeah, really appreciate everything you're doing and for coming on our podcast. And yeah, we hope we'll catch up with you again another time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.